From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. There is hope that the Australian government's defeat in the Wentworth by-election on Saturday could lead to a change in its offshore detention policy. It's estimated between 13 and 1,500 refugees are still living in exile in Papua New Guinea and Nauru, where many are suffering from the grave effects of 5 years of indefinite detention. Ben Robinson-Drawbridge has more.
Prompted by the resignation from Parliament of the deposed Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, the by-election was won by independent candidate Kieran Phelps, whose victory, when confirmed, will cancel the government's one-seat majority and create a hung parliament. Dr. Phelps told the ABC Australia needed to bring an end to the cruel and unusual punishment of offshore detention.
First order of business is to get the kids off Nauru with their families to Australia for urgent medical and psychological help. The resettlement options should be explored, and New Zealand is an extremely good option, and it's definitely something that I'd like to look at. There are refugee advocates who've spoken to me about that being at least a very good interim position, and so it's definitely on the table.
The Australian government says it would accept New Zealand's offer to resettle 150 of the refugees if opposition MPs support its bill to ban all offshore detainees from ever entering Australia. The opposition Labor and Green parties say they'd support a ban that only applied to refugees resettled in New Zealand. Independent MP Andrew Wilkie, who this week introduced a bill to evacuate children and their families from Nauru, told the ABC he could be willing to compromise.
It would be with a heavy heart that I would accept that sort of compromise, and it would be with very strict conditions. For a start, they can't trickle to New Zealand over years. They all have to go, everyone, kids, adults, in one lot, all to New Zealand.
Whether New Zealand would take more than 150 refugees banned from entering Australia was put to the office of Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, but not answered by deadline. Advocate Ian Rintoul from the Refugee Action Coalition says with a general election due in Australia by May, the opposition should not compromise.
We see this condition as being an unnecessary, you know, concession, particularly given that Labor's policy, and Labor is very, very likely to be the next government, Labor's policy is not to, you know, have any kind of concession or travel ban.
Refugee advocate Jana Favero from the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre says 52 children remain on Nauru, about 30 of whom she believes to be in a critical condition. Ms Favero says the election of Kieran Phelps is cause for hope.
So with another crossbench member, we are hoping that pressure will increase and that we can get those children brought here urgently. As you know, doctors have been telling us, it's an absolute miracle that a child has not died already. And if we continue this case-by-case situation, there's a very real risk that a child will die. So they do need to all be brought to Australia for care and treatment with some urgency.
Manus Island refugee Behrouz Buchani says refugees would accept a ban on travelling to Australia if they were resettled in America or New Zealand. He says the by-election has given refugees hope that things in Canberra are changing.
Many political things change over the past 5 years, but nothing positive happened for us. But this time I think we should be hopeful, because we have a great support by some politicians in the parliament for the first time.
Sentiment could also be changing in the Australian community, as demonstrated by about 1,000 protesters at the Children's March for Nauru in Melbourne on Sunday.
Morrison, Dutton, Shorten, we are marching now and will be voting soon. This generation has a conscience, and your cruel policies of locking people up do not fly with us.
But political scientist Binoy Campmark from Melbourne's RMIT University says he's sceptical that the by-election winner will be able to bring about the evacuation of refugee children from Nauru to Australia.
The reality is that the government, and to a certain extent the Labor Party in opposition, they are also hedging their bets as to a policy that is, on the one hand, you know, responsive to removing the refugees from the island, but on the other hand, not sure where they go afterwards. And the government seems to be very much in favour of preventing them from returning or coming to Australia, except in the most extreme circumstances. And that's something that I don't think Phelps is necessarily going to change.
Dr. Campmark says despite the spotlight shone on Nauru by the Wentworth by-election, the majority of Australians may be so hardened to offshore detention that they accept its human consequences. This is Ben Robinson Drawbridge.
Papua New Guinea's National AIDS Council says 5 years of budget cuts have caused the number of HIV infections to creep up again. In 2013, the rate fell to 0.65% after a decade-long awareness and antiviral campaign. But now the council secretary, Tony Lapama, says the rate has crept up to 0.9% after years of limited funding. While the rate is significantly lower than in the epidemic of the late 1990s and early 2000s, where thousands died, the trend is worrying, Mr. Lapoa. He told Jamie Tahana, another nationwide HIV/AIDS awareness campaign is solely needed, as well as a new plan for better procurement of antiviral drugs.
We are now implementing the new HIV STI and HIV strategy, which indicates very strongly in our directive that we have to ensure that we have the treatment stocks being sustained for longer periods of time, meaning that we have now systems and processes which are putting in place to ensure that there's enough reporting coming from the provinces to ensure that the new stocks are in place before the current stocks run out.
A hospital will know its supplies and then predict when it's going to run out and then you'll order a tin or something.
Yeah.
Kind of how does it work practically?
They have on the ground procurement officers for each province. They monitor the stocks, and before the stocks run out, they're supposed to get in contact with the national level to ensure that they have new stocks coming before the current stocks run out.
Overall in the country, how is the fight against HIV/AIDS going? Because you had dramatic improvements for a decade, sort of up until about 2012, and then it held steady for a bit. Has there been a spike? Has it stalled, or are you still sort of successfully fighting it?
Our program sort of died out, went down for about 2 years because of budget cuts. We didn't have enough money coming from the government to continue these programs. But, you know, during that time, we were lucky that we had donor partners who were giving us money to continue the programs. And we haven't done bad. I mean, we've managed to keep the prevalence of HIV below 2% since 2004. And we actually saw the prevalence of HIV go down as far as 0.65% in 2013. But now with lower funding from the government, which means that we cannot do sustained programs in the provinces, the prevalence has now starting to rise up to 0.9% by 2017-18. So we, in this new strategy, are trying to ensure that the prevalence remains below 1%.
It's still below 1%, but an increase is an increase, and for such a terrible illness, that's exactly not what you want. So with this new strategy you're launching, do you get an increased budget with it, or is this a case of trying to make do with what you've got from after the cuts in government funding with sort of whatever donor funding you have left?
Yeah, well, we are managing with what we have, but there's still a lot of challenges and we need more support. And that's why we are submitting to the government that, look, the HIV prevalence is starting to rise again, and we need to go back to doing mass awareness, and we need to speed up the rollout of voluntary counseling and testing, because that's what's going to lead us to...
Right, so what you really need is sort of another big campaign like you had a decade ago, because you're seeing numbers creep up again.
Yeah, we need to go back to what we did a decade ago, and that is mass awareness and mass promotion of condoms.
Do you think that message is being heeded? Is the government looking to give you some of that funding, or are you still trying?
We are trying, and we have a very good minister who used to be the Secretary for Health before, and he's very supportive, and through him we believe the government will give us extra money in the 2019 budget.
Solomon Islands will have its first countrywide geohazard monitoring system. New Zealand's GNS has led the development. The project leader, Craig Miller, says it will increase the country's capacity to identify, manage, and detect hazards such as earthquakes, tsunamis, and volcanoes. Dr. Miller told Corona Vakuatu, work is almost completed.
There's one station that operates in Honiara, which is actually run by the USGS as part of an international network, but that's the only station in the whole country. We've been adding six new stations across the country, and those will be all connected to a new data centre in Honiara, where they'll be able to locate their own earthquakes and then start to make their own hazard assessments related to earthquakes and potentially tsunamis, and also monitor a couple of active volcanoes.
And if anything, I guess the recent activity in places like Indonesia show how important it is to have these warning systems and monitoring networks in place.
That's absolutely right. So instead of having to rely on international agencies, such as the Pacific Tsunami Warning Centre, as the only source of information, then having your own capability really goes a long way in that regard. The international agencies are still very important, but developing your own capability to make your own assessments based on your own local knowledge is also very important.
These monitoring stations, how do they work in layman's terms?
Broadly, we have a seismometer, which is a device we put underground and detects the earth shaking. It's connected to a data logger, which is connected to a satellite transmission system, and that sends the data continuously back over the satellite link back to the office in Honiara, and that's connected to some computer software that monitors the incoming signals, and it detects earthquakes and automatically locates them and can notify people. And that all takes place within a minute or two of an earthquake occurring.
You kind of mentioned there, while the international networks are important, that this will add a bit of speed to possibly to responses. Are there any other benefits here?
Yeah, the main thing it'll do, by adding extra stations in the Solomon Islands area, it'll actually improve accuracy of earthquake location, including both position and also the magnitude. Position and magnitude are important for when you're making assessments about whether the likelihood of an earthquake generating a tsunami or not.
And there will be technical assistance around this as well to help staff operate this?
So we've been training both the local Solomon Islands seismology staff there, working with their National Disaster Management Office and their Met Service Office to kind of help tie these agencies together. And between the three of them, they're kind of responsible for issuing hazard warnings in the Solomon Islands. So we've been looking at developing protocols for them to talk to each other and sharing messages and that sort of thing.
And when do you hope to have this project sewn up in the Solomon Islands?
So we have approximately three stations running at the moment, and we hope by the end of October to have the rest of the network operational. We'll be going back up there at the end of the month to finish up a few things and to complete training and hand over.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Papua New Guinea's civil society organizations say the logging industry is robbing the country of hundreds of millions of kinda every year. The civil society spokesman cites two reports which alleged progressive, deliberate, and continued acts of tax evasion by foreign-owned mining and logging companies operating in PNG. Melvin Lavango reports from PNG.
The Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative Report 2016 and the Auckland Institute Report 2018 confirmed that huge increases in mining and logging have not seen a matching increase in tax revenue. A civil society spokesperson, Priscilla Carra, says both reports confirm tax evasion amounting to hundreds of millions of kina every year, which is money lost to PNG economy.
The income derived in turn for Papua New Guinea is minimal, insignificant, and totally disproportionate to the total value of raw exports that leave our shores.
Ms. Carras says logging and mining's largest contribution to national income is from tax on wages, a third of which is paid by employees. PNG corporate income tax rate is 30% for local companies and 48% for foreign-owned ones operating in the country. The Auckland Institute is a progressive U.S. think tank which subtitled its report, The Great Timber Haste Continued. Its Hata Frederick Mosau says despite PNG becoming the world's largest exporter of tropical timber, it is losing tax revenue through various forms of avoidance by the almost entirely foreign-owned and controlled industry.
for several years, exports between 3 million and 4 million cubic meters every year by these logging companies, mostly going to China. And these companies were plundering Papua New Guinea and making people destitute and dispossessed of their own land and resources are not even contributing to the public revenue and to the economy of the country.
Mr. Mosau says the industry convinces many people it is operating for the benefit of the country, but he says the increase in logging exports has largely been made possible by illegally granted special agriculture and business leases, or SABLs. An anti-corruption activist, Pamela Avusi, highlights what she calls the fraudulent land grabs in her area of West Pomeo.
The landowners are left suffering. Their land was taken away from them for 99 years without their consent, and to get their land back, they're still battling this in court.
The executive director of PNG's Institute of National Affairs, Paul Barker, says illegality in logging is nothing new. He says legislation was introduced in the late 1970s to empower the landowners and encourage sustainable forest management that would produce ongoing revenue for PNG and its people. But 30 years on, and he says corruption reigns.
We constantly see the power and that growing power of the industry to have very strong influence, sometimes in the highest places, to circumvent the efforts to be able to manage the industry responsibly, accountably, for, as I say, the landowner's best interests.
PNG civil society spokesperson Priscilla Kare says they are petitioning the government for action. She cites Malaysian Rimbunan Hijau, which has doubled its financial loss over 6 years while increasing its exports by 40%, as the worst offender. Civil society is calling on the Prime Minister and the National Executive Council, the Internal Revenue Commission, and other state agencies to treat this matter with great concern and urgency. This is Melvin Levongo.
An online movement is raising awareness about discrimination faced by Melanesian immigrants in Hawaii. A thread under the Being Micronesian has exposed the abuse and discrimination they face living in the U.S. state. Tim Glasgow filed this report before a forum this week to address the issue.
I hate Micronesians. Stupid, lazy, promiscuous, unreliable, and entitled.
I love watching the movie Avatar, and inside I'm always giggling and laughing because they all look and sound like tall Micronesians, but smarter and clearer on the English.
Roving packs of feral animals, essentially. It's getting to the point where something needs to be done.
These are just some of the comments Sha Ongilongo has collected over the last 3 years. The Palawan started what she calls the anti-Micronesian thread of shame under the hashtag Being Micronesian movement to expose the vicious attitudes towards her people who live in Hawaii. And she says the discrimination extends beyond derogatory jokes.
It's discrimination, but at the same time, it makes its way into policy, into housing issues, into education, into healthcare. And when that happens, it's no longer the way people keep describing it. It's not just jokes about an ethnic group. It becomes an actual problem with our ability to kind of live.
Sha Ongilongel says that while her movement has exposed such abuse, it has also created a sense of solidarity among the Micronesian community and others who support the cause in Hawaii.
They've become stronger and more powerful in their identities. They've become more assertive because in seeing what goes on and seeing what people think of them, it's strengthened their resolve to be themselves.
She says bringing these issues to light has given young Micronesian people the chance to be proud of their culture in the face of discrimination.
For us, holding on to our culture, holding on to our traditions, our heritage, that's an important thing. That's our identity. And so being able to hold on to these things and still be parts of the community, still go to school, go to our jobs, don't have to give up your identity to not even survive, just to flourish.
There are estimated to be about 15,000 Micronesians in Hawaii. A journalist for Honolulu's Civil Beat, Chad Blair, says those who have come from the Federated States of Micronesia, Marshall Islands and Palau have entitlements under the Compact of Free Association with the U.S. that are widely misunderstood in Hawaii.
Micronesians under the COFA Treaty have a legal right to live and work here indefinitely. That is covered under the treaty. They are not illegal aliens. They're essentially legal aliens, but it's a unique status that they have.
Chad Blair says many Micronesians move to Hawaii for better health services, education and job opportunities. He says while many do become homeless, many are also hardworking people who are providing for their families.
Check your prejudice at the door, and when you see a Micronesian working at a Subway food store or at 7-Eleven or at a parking lot, or frankly, being your medical doctor or your lawyer or your teacher, ask them who they are, where they're from, and get to know them. And someone sincerely shows an interest, I see their faces light up. They want nothing more than to be able to tell their story.
The U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and the Hawaii Advisory Committee are holding a meeting this week to hear from members of the Micronesian community. Mary Therese Perez-Hattori is a professor at Chaminade University in Honolulu and originally from Guam. She hopes the meeting will provide the impetus for change at a higher level.
What we share with them could actually show up in a report that they'll send to Congress and the president. And so it could have an impact at a federal level. These venues for having our concerns heard at both the state and federal level are rare. And so I think this is a very good sign.
Professor Perez-Hattori says she hopes having a chance to talk about their struggles will help Micronesians living in Hawaii.
People are talking, and we're trying to work in, you know, positive ways to focus our discussion. So while we are sharing concerns that do seem very negative, we're also focused on what are the solutions and how can we move forward together in as harmonious a way as possible.
Professor Perez-Hattori says it's important that the future generations of Micronesians respect Hawaiian culture, but also become advocates for their own community. I'm Tim Glasgow.
And finally, the Fijian Dura have secured the Australian National Rugby Championship Minor Premiership after a come-from-behind victory over the Western Force in Perth. The visitors trailed 14-0 after 10 minutes on Saturday afternoon, but the four second-half tries sealed a 33-28 win, their sixth win in seven games. The home semifinals against the Canberra Vikings in Lakota this weekend. The coach, Senesai Senekavula, told Vinnie Viley it was the hardest game they've played all season.
Very proud of the boys that we really need a win and to grant us for a home semifinal, and they did that. They performed it.
Yeah, and to do it away from home, to do it against the team closest to you on the standings, a very good Western Force team that, you know, not long ago, obviously they were playing Super Rugby, and to come from behind as well.
Certainly. We need to understand that the Ndrua, they're local players, and the competition is and we believe the competition is not strong here in Fiji. And to be playing against Super Rugby teams and Super Rugby players, and that's a big, massive development from last year.
It's not the first time your team this season have had to, you know, fight at the end to get the result. What do you put that down to, the belief of your players to go the 480?
They have the confidence. That's the one of our strengths, is getting confidence every game, every week, and they can play 80 minutes. And some of the game that we have to chase the game, and so that's huge for these local players.
Last year you guys made the playoffs. That was a huge achievement. This year you've ratched it up a couple of notches even further. You know, at what point do you acknowledge that, you know, you guys are clearly at this level and excelling at this level and what the team could be capable of?
This is a massive achievement for Fiji Rugby, and especially these local players performing in this level. So this is what the Fiji Rugby Union has to look at into our competition and make it stronger here in Fiji. And also these guys, for their pathways, going up to the Flying Pigeon or securing a contract overseas.
And obviously you've got the home playoff now. You made the playoffs last season and were beaten. What did you learn from that experience?
Last year was not a good year for us when we were going towards the semi-final, and we lost some of our experienced players going to the Flying Pigeon. But this year it's different. They're all going to be here. So that's a big bonus for us going into the semi-final.
And you'll be playing a Canberra team you played only a few weeks ago at home, a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, we're playing the Vikings in the semi-final. So I think it's a big boost for them also. the way they play here in 2 weeks' time. But we just need to prepare well and focus to what we want to do on Saturday.
And going into the playoffs, Senna Rossi, are you believing you can win this tournament now? Or is that something you're telling to the players? Is that the expectation?
Yes, the message is for the even the individual players. Now they realize that we only lost one game and we've played all the team in the NRC. So if we can keep on doing what we're doing, and I think this will be a good year for the draw.
And that's all we have time for in this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple, pcjmedia@gmail.com. Also, let us know where you heard the program. Anyway, that's all we have time for. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. But a quick reminder, those who are tuning into the Pacific right now have the opportunity to listen to Focus Asia Pacific 3 times daily, not hosted by yours truly, but by somebody else. So yeah, do tune in. Anyway, we'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.